as human beings, we filter our experience. We sort it into likes and dislikes, things we want to repeat and things we don't want to repeat. And here is something that I do not want to repeat, if you, any of you can see that far. I do not want to repeat this. I was playing soccer with my grandsons. I have to figure out how to play with my grandsons and not repeat this once I'm able to play again. So that helps us function, sorting things into likes and dislikes, and things we want to repeat and things we don't want to repeat. That's how we get along in the world. That's a key to good function. Now, even if I do my best, I may end up running around with them and doing it again, but that would be kind of foolish, don't you think? So the problem with this filtering of experience is that we tend to want to only accept the perfect, unblemished fruit. Zen practice teaches us to do our best to say yes to everything at the deepest level, including the difficult, whether it's loss, boredom, anger, confusion, or discomfort. Here's a poem by Jane Hirschfield. Jane, who is a contemporary American poet and who practiced at Tassajara Zen Monastery years ago. A poem she wrote recently about her experience years ago at Tassajara. Even now, decades after, I wash my face with cold water, not for discipline, nor memory, nor the icy awakening slap, but to practice choosing to make the unwanted wanted. One more time. Even now, decades later, I wash my face with cold water, not for discipline, nor memory, nor the icy awakening slap, but to practice choosing to make the wanted unwanted. Excuse me, the unwanted wanted. That's interesting. The unwanted wanted. So, for the last few weeks, I have had a practice partner. Now, those of you who've done practice periods here know that the teachers assign practice partners. And the practice partner you meet with for the whole 8 weeks. You meet once a week. But you don't always get assigned the practice partner you want. I got this practice partner. I'm lifting her up. I didn't want her. I didn't ask for her. I got her. She's my practice partner. She's been my practice partner for several weeks. She's going to be my practice partner in a different form for several more weeks. So this kind of acceptance isn't so much about forcing ourselves to accept, oh, I got this, or even shrugging our shoulders, but about really, really being with the experience, really being with the experience, learning from it. This is called self-power in Zen. Planting ourselves deeply in the nature of what surrounds us. This is what surrounds me. This surrounds me. This dictates every moment of my day and night. It surrounds me. Can I plant myself deeply into it? Into its nature? I think so. That's Zen practice, right? I think so. You could say acceptance, but it's more than just sort of stoicism. It's what is. It's what is. Much as possible to be intimate with our difficulties. This means thought has to remain flexible, right? My calculating mind warns me to be wary of things that are different or out of the ordinary. This is really different, out of the ordinary. We're afraid of anything that appears wild or out of our control. But the world and our bodies harbor countless wilderness areas, wild areas, and ecosystems self-regulating mechanisms that give us life and consciousness, and we can't control them. We can't control them. But these mechanisms do cooperate. This foot, this severed tendon, which now has been sutured together, will heal itself. All I need to do is plant myself deeply into listening to it, paying attention to it, and caring for this practice partners that I did not ask to get. What Zen teacher decided to give me this practice partner? I don't want to hang out with that Zen teacher anymore. But this is the practice partner I got. Caring for my practice partner. Caring about my practice partner. And then I have auxiliary people who are helping me. People who help me into the Zendo, especially my wife and my doctor. So the world and our bodies harbor countless wild areas like this, which are beyond our control. And wildness doesn't mean crazed. It's simply what is. Uncalculated, undiluted, unadorned. So we take refuge, but not from wildness, but in wildness. So this is all a preface to my talk this morning, where I got about a third of it done already, I guess. So I'm giving two talks now. This talk is two talks on nature. This talk is more on mountains, and the next talk that I give on the 10th will be more on water. And I'm using Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra to refer to. Sutra is very interesting. So we have all these sutras, all these scriptures, all these texts. And sutra, etymologically, has the same derivation, although in a different language, as suture, to sew together. We sew together. So that's what the sutras do. The sutras help us sew together when we're split apart from our natural engagement with life, when our natural connectedness to life. We're sewing it together. When we read the sutra, when we recite the sutra, when we think about the sutra, it helps us. It helps us. And in this case, this is the Mountains and Water Sutra. So he is saying, well, first of all, he's kind of audacious in saying what he's writing is a sutra, because Zen teachers don't usually say that. The sutras happened, you know, centuries ago. But he has the audacity to say this is his sutra, and it's the Mountains and Water Sutra. It's about the mountains and waters as healers, as mentors in showing us how to suture ourselves so we can return to wholeness. So I'm going to talk about five stanzas from the sutra on mountains today, and then next time I'll talk about water. And I think I did put the five stanzas in your programs if you'd like to follow along. It's just up to you. Number one, these mountains and waters of the present are expressions of the ancient Buddhas. All phenomena realize completeness. Because they exist before the eon of emptiness, they are living in the present. Because they are the self before the appearance of any sign, they are liberated. So mountains and waters are expressing the teachings of the Buddhas and the ancient sages. They're expressing them just as they are. Nature sews us back together. We're so lucky to have this lake here and have this backyard and have a little wilderness area we walk in, kind of wild. Wild enough so that we can feel the connectedness to the earth, to the sky, to everything. Shows us how to be free from the plague of regretting, reviewing, and rehearsing. These mountains and waters of the present are expressions of the ancient Buddhas. all phenomena realize completeness. So before we divide in what we like and what we hate, mountains and waters are teaching us constantly how to express the reality of being joined to all life. They're showing us that just by how being how they are. Just by being how they are. Because they exist before the eon of emptiness, they are living in the present. So mountains exist before the appearance of any thought that divides us from them. They're present right here. Because they are the self before the appearance of any sign, they are free and unhindered in their activities. So the self of the mountain, of the rock, of the earth, can only appear because of us. We can only appear because there is earth, water, rocks, and mountains. This self is present before any symbol or sign called rock or earth or mountain. Those symbols and signs are fine, but they divide us up. And then we have to suture when we feel divided. And they show us how to do that before we label them. All phenomena realize completeness. Because they exist before the eon of emptiness, they are living in the present. Because they are the self, before the appearance of any sign, they are free and unhindered in their activities. The self of the mountain, the self of the rock, can only appear because of us. We can only appear because there's earth, water, rocks, mountains. Pretty cool. Pretty wonderful. This self is present before any symbol, any sign. Second stanza. Because mountains are big and broad, the way of riding the clouds is always reached from the mountains. The power of soaring in the wind comes freely from the mountains. Being big and broad, going beyond our comfort zone, beyond the limits of our small, regretting, reviewing, rehearsing self. Embracing life and all of its confusion, all of its contradictions. And then we're Taoist sages. He's quoting the Taoists now. He never tells us when he's quoting anyone. He never does that. This is right out of the early Taoist stuff. Because mountains are big and broad, the way of riding the clouds, which Chuangzi is always talking about, riding the clouds, is always reached from the mountains. The power of soaring in the wind comes freely from the mountains. So, for the last two or three weeks, I've had this cast. Before I had this cast, I had a boot. Before that, I didn't have anything, and I was just hanging out in my daughter's house in France, and they were figuring out when I could come home and how they'd get me home. But I've had this boot. So, I mean, I've had this cast and the crutches. So for the last 2.5 weeks, how do I get my pants on? How do I get them on? Do I have to rip them first? How many people need to help me get my pair of pants on? What kinds of pair? Can we find a pair of pants I can get on at all? That's my practice. That's my practice partner. My practice partner is a little different from the usual practice partner. Forces me to pay attention, right? Just be with it. Just be with it. Just be open to it. Oh, there must be a way to get some pants on. I want to go over to Zen Center and I have an appointment. So, Linda, can't we figure a way? Oh, maybe, Linda, are you willing to go buy me some pants? Oh, well, I go to Target. Well, let's measure me and see if we can find any pants. How do I go to the bathroom? We won't get into that, right? How do I go to the bathroom? Here I am on the first floor. I can't get up to the third floor unless I go up on my butt, which actually I'm pretty good at doing now. But then I get in the back. Well, I won't get into all that stuff. But you get it, right? This practice partner of mine, pretty wonderful. Pretty awful, pretty wonderful. Just what is. And now I'll have my cast removed, I think on Tuesday. Then for 6 weeks, I'm going to have a boot up to my knee. Oh, my practice partner will be taking a different form then. What will that be like? What will I need to pay attention to then? Will I have to get another pair of pants? Full catastrophe living. Zorba the Greek, right?
Yeah.
Full catastrophe living. Zorba's young companion turns to him and inquires, "Zorba, have you ever been married?" To which Zorba replies, "Am I not a man? Of course I've been married. Wife, house, kids, everything, the full catastrophe." What's not to be joyful about? Really, what's not to be joyful about? It's what is. It's what is. The third stanza. The green mountains are always walking. A stone woman gives birth to a child at night. Mountains walking is just like human walking. Accordingly, do not doubt mountains walking, even though it does not look the same as human walking. It doesn't seem like mountains walk, but they do. They do. Every year I go to the same little place in the Caribbean in the winter, and there's a big mountain out in the backyard. And if my mind is fresh in the morning when I look out, it's the first time I've seen it. It's different. The colors are different. The way the sun is shining on it is different. The shadows are different. It's always walking. But if I just say, "Oh, that's the mountain," I never even see it at all. It's all the same, but it's not the same. It's walking. It's moving. Everything. Everything. Good sign of whether I'm really doing my zazen. I don't mean my sitting zazen, but I mean my living zazen. When I see that mountain, do I see it not separate from it? Just as it is, without any conception? It's walking then. It's walking. And if I wait and look at it for 5 minutes, I see how it changes. I see how the shadows change. I see how the birds change. I see how even the flowers change. The green mountains are always walking. A stone woman gives birth to a child at night. A stone woman. He's quoting an ancient Chinese story here. Again, he doesn't reference an ancient Chinese story. The stone woman bears a child by night. So stone seems dense. Look at all the stones we have on the path in the backyard. We do that walking meditation every morning, although I don't. Look at those stones. They're just regular stones. There's nothing particular about them. They look dead. They're colorless. Kind of tannish. But if you really look at them, look at one stone, it bubbles with possibility. It teems with life. If you really look at it, you'll see that. You feel that inside, too. You feel it. So, over the years here at Zen Center and before my private practice, I've met with a lot of people with depression. A lot of people. And within the stone-like inertia of depression, you don't want to do anything. Ugh. You don't want to do anything. You're feeling inert. You don't have energy. Maybe you can drag yourself up to the Zen Center. Maybe you can go for a little walk. But you don't want to do anything. Everything is just gray and dull. But Dogen says, right within your depression, your stone-like inertia, you could bear a child. You could bear a child. Well, psychologists know that the best thing for depression is contradictory. It's to do something. It doesn't matter what you do, just to do something. The more stone-like you are, the more you should do something. And the ancient Egyptians I read about this recently online. The ancient Egyptians' hieroglyphics, they talk about depression in their hieroglyphics. And they say, for depression, you should travel and dance. For depression, you should travel and dance. The stone woman bears a child by night. Don't want to do it, but then when you do it, how much different do you feel? How much more alive do you feel? A fourth stanza. If you doubt mountains walking, you do not know or understand your own walking. If you know your own walking, you know the mountains walking. Also examine walking backward and backward walking, and investigate that walking forward and backward never stopped since before form arose. So, just walking, just moving, with your practice partner. Not saying, I'm too depressed to do anything, I'm too anxious to do anything, I'm too disabled physically to do anything. Traveling and dancing with my practice partner. Call it. Maybe somebody may label it depression or anxiety or a broken tendon. I travel and dance with it. That's my practice. That's our practice. Dogen says, also examine walking backward and backward walking and investigate that walking forward and backward never stopped since before form arose. So, we could say he's talking about meditation when he says in another sutra, take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward. Take the backward step that turns the light and shines it inward. Whatever you're concerned about, trace it to the root, where there's no inside or outside. Whatever I'm concerned about, trace it to the root, which there's no inside or outside. Consciousness says, I'm here, and you guys are all out there. Trace this thought to a place closer and nearer, closer and nearer. Turn the light inward and trace this thought. So near that there's no division, that we're sutured, and we're no longer separating ourselves. Wow. Is it possible? I think so. Suturing until the stitches vanish and you're whole. You've been whole anyway, but you got mixed up and you were in a lot of pain. So you need to suture yourself so you can return to this feeling of wholeness. So I'm going to see the doctor on Tuesday, and I don't know whether I'm fully sutured or not. I'll find out. Will I still need my stitches for a while? Are they just going to fall away, body and mind dropping away? Will I have to be removed when I go in to see him the next time? I don't know. All I have to do is be with my practice partner and see what happens. So, if you have... I talked to someone a while ago who had been to three retreats here, and all three retreats, she was doing fine, and then she felt really sad, just really sad. And that's kind of came on her just the way, as a wave, and she felt really sad. And so then she questioned whether she should do retreats or not. And I said, oh, well, how about just being with her? How about just being with her? How about just getting closer to your sadness until it's not personal, until it's molecular, until it belongs to everyone? Who is there who's not sad sometimes? It's walking, it's moving, it's not something to get stuck on, just to be with it, just to take care of it. Whatever we're concerned about, just to gently and easily trace it to the root. Trace it to the root. And we're sutured. We're sutured. That's a suturing process. Well. And lo and behold, the unwanted is wanted. Right in the middle of our sadness, there's some tranquility. Right in the middle of that sadness, there's some ease. Right in the middle of it. So here's a short poem by Dogen. If you follow the river all the way back to its source, there are clouds. If you follow the clouds all the way back to their source, there is the river. The place where the observer and the observed meet. Where they meet. So the fifth and last stanza. Clearly examine the Green Mountains walking and your own walking. This is called the mountain's flow and the flowing mountain. The mountain always practices in every place. Mountains belong to people who love them. So everything about mountains is also about you. Mountains and you are moving together, dancing together. They don't exist without us, and we don't exist without them. Pretty wonderful. Pretty wonderful. This is called the mountain's flow and the flowing mountain. An endless spring forth. An endless giving ourselves away. Moment after moment. Forever. Forever. Practice. Practice enlightenment. Then he says, the mountain always practices in every place. Mountain always practices in every place. Everything in the world's alive and is expressing itself. Everything is exerting its life just by being. Just by being. Completely living instead of getting all entangled in regretting, reviewing, and rehearsing. We have to do some regretting, reviewing, and rehearsing. I have to do some reviewing and rehearsing so that I don't take care of this tendon, right? Just to get in this door, I had to rehearse. This is the third or fourth time I've come in, so we already have it worked out. We get the chair there on the back walk, just at the right place. I don't take my crutches on the cobblestones too hard. I go on the grass. Then I have to take only one step on the cobblestone. And I get on the chair, I rest for a minute, and I take my crutches in. So that's a lot of rehearsing. That's good. That's good. We need that. It's good that human beings could do that. But do we need to spend 80 to 90% of our time in doing this? It only takes about 10% of your time. If you're spending more than 10% of your time doing this stuff, do more zazen, do more suturing, do a lot more. Do a lot more. Do a lot more. Mountains, this is his last phrase I'm doing today. Mountains belong to people who love them. Mountains belong to people who love them. So this resonates for me personally, and I hope it, I bet it resonates for many of you, but it resonates for me personally. When I was about 7 or 8, I started going with my parents and my sister to hiking into a high camp in the Sierras called Golden Trout Camp. And we hiked in every year for several years, and I loved being up there. And then later, as an adult, I spent time in the Wind Rivers area, hiking and backpacking. I thought Paul might be here today. He was our leader, but I don't think he's here. Our leader. So, mountains belong to people who love them. We feel when we're in the mountain, it helps us let go of all this stuff inside, all this junk inside, doesn't it? Just helps us. We see it, we're with it, we experience it. It really slows us down. It really slows us down. But we shouldn't romanticize mountains. Be careful about romanticizing mountains. They're wild. They're beyond like and dislike. They're just what they are. They're wild. So about maybe 20 years ago, I was with my friends in the Wind Rivers area. We hiked in for maybe, I don't know, let's say we were 5 or 6 days hiked in, pretty high, maybe 9,000 feet, I don't know. And we decided we would each do an overnight solo in the mountains, an overnight solo. So where you go out and you're just there for the whole night and you do your best to do your zazen moment after moment and don't sleep. We didn't take sleeping bags. I think we had ponchos. So it was cool. It was cool. But when we went out just before dark, the sky was beautifully clear. We all found our places. And luckily for me, I'd done enough rehearsing so that I found a low place to go. But my friends, some of them went to higher places. Well, what happened is it got dark and a huge storm came up. Huge mountain storm. Thunder, lightning, rain, wind. And we had made this commitment just to do it, just to be with it. And nobody was monitoring us. But we were doing our jiriki practice, our self-practice. So we stayed. It was mostly miserable. Mostly miserable. But we stayed the whole night. And then we kind of dragged ourselves in the morning. It stopped raining. And we dragged ourselves back to the camp, and we had lots of war stories to tell each other. You know, guy war stories, right? So it was awful, but we stayed with it. We wanted to run. I learned, as I keep forgetting and relearning, that if I can merge with one thing, I can merge with anything, everything. I always forget that. And then I practice. I get a new practice partner. A new opportunity. Furthermore, when we're deeply in love with mountains, there's the stillness of the mountains emanating from us. Just emanating from us. So we don't love them any less when they misbehave. Those mountains really misbehaved. How could they do that to us? Not one night. The whole other 2 weeks were completely clear. But that night, they totally misbehaved. Nature is wild. It's not crazed. It's simply what is. Beyond any sense of wanted or unwanted. It's what is. So, it's possible, I think, for us to get to know mountains well enough so we don't love them less if they misbehave. It's possible to get to know ourselves well enough so that we don't love ourselves any less if we misbehave. Is it possible? I think so. So I want to close with the two Taoist quotes. Lao Tzu. The world is sacred. It can't be improved. If you tamper with it, you'll ruin it. If you treat it like an object, you'll lose it. So instead of doing good in order to feel better about yourself, or doing in order to avoid pain, or doing in order to avoid failure, we practice doing non-doing. Wu Wei, doing non-doing. By being with whatever practice partner we have, and just listening, just paying attention, just dancing sometimes, although sometimes that dance looks very awkward and it doesn't feel like a dance at all. And then Lao Tzu says again, nature does not hurry, yet everything is accomplished. Nature does not hurry, yet everything is accomplished. This is natural. This is not nature out there. This is us. This is us. Our nature. Our Buddha nature. It doesn't hurry, yet everything is accomplished. So, take care of your practice partner, and she'll take care of you. Take care of your practice partner. She'll take care of you. The more you listen to her, the more you be with her, the more you learn from her, the more she'll take care of you, the more she'll heal. And you guys will both heal together. You'll both heal together. You'll be sutured. You'll be sutured. So that's what I want to say this morning. And I want to thank this practice partner for giving me the opportunity to give a talk about her. God, it's good she's good for something, isn't it? So we have a little time for questions or comments. Benton.
You can see mountains walking right now in Hawaii.
In Hawaii. Yeah. Yeah, well, those mountains are really walking. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't think we want our mountains to walk that much, do we? But, you know, they're wild. They're wild. And we're wild, too. We're wild, too. But we want to contain everything. We think we can get everything figured out so it won't be wild anymore. And then we tear a tendon. It reminds us. Ooh! Ooh! Larry! Good to see you, Larry. Welcome home.
Sorry to hear about your report.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. One of them practical, the other more philosophical. Practical question. I had a hiking accident about a month ago myself up in Tucson.
Uh-huh.
I fell down on the trail. It was this real rocky trail.
Uh-huh.
So, first couple of days, you know, I was limping along, you know, up and along, and started to feel it was somehow all of a sudden I get really old.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, you know, I went to the doctor, they told me I couldn't run for 46 weeks.
Uh-huh.
So that made it feel worse.
Yeah.
And so then, like, this feeling of being old, I didn't want to be with that. You know, I felt like I wanted to, it was like the state of mind, like, I start feeling old, you know, and I'm kind of done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of, like in running, a lot of times you go through a lot of, you know, little aches and pains, and you can kind of go through, it's very meditative.
Did you say that again?
I see in running, like, it's very similar to meditative.
Uh-huh.
Like you go through a lot of aches and pains a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that they just rise up and go away. So I'm wondering, like, with this being with it idea, how do you balance that, you know, with sort of letting these things go and just sort of being in the moment and not sort of getting caught in this like state of feeling old or something like that.
Well, I got, so could you guys hear him? Mm-hmm. Oh, they couldn't hear you. Gee. well, do you want to say it again or shall I try to say it? You could just say it briefly in a really loud voice,
okay,
or do you want me to try and say it?
Basically, this, how do you balance these feeling of all of a sudden feeling like you're old and you can't do anything, you know, and you're done. You know, being with that versus, you know, sort of being in the moment and not sort of hanging on to that, you know, like kind of letting that go. How would you, because your idea is to kind of, this is your partner, you know. I didn't really necessarily want to deal with this bum me with my partner.
Uh-huh.
So I've been like therapy and kind of, you know, gradually getting back.
Uh-huh.
How do you balance that?
Yeah. Well, that's just your practice, isn't it? Could you guys get the gist of what he said, or should I say it? Raise your hand if you could get the gist of what he said. Oh, they could. Okay. So, well, that's your practice. I mean, the label, if I label myself old, well, I am old. I am old. I just turned 75. By normal, by any yardstick, that's considered old. Now people say, oh, it's not old. But 75 is a new 65. Is a new 65. Well, people, 65 is old too, right? So you could hardly say it's not old. But if I think about old, if I think of myself as old, I get limited by that thought. Then I start thinking, oh, I, you know, this is, I'm like you say, I'm beginning to waste away. You know, I can't do things physical anymore. So old may be tentatively, using that label is okay. It's actually important, but it's just a tentative label. If it's something that I get in my mind, then I become fixated on it, and I'm not dancing with the mountains anymore. I'm not dancing with my practice partner anymore. So I notice that fixation. There it is. I'm gentle with it, but I remind myself it's just a word, it's just a social convention, and come back. And actually, you know, somebody said to me a while ago, in your talks you always say you're getting old. So I said, I haven't said it lately. So I thought, I say it, and then it concretizes it. And then I start thinking, oh, I'm old. But if I don't say it anymore, it's still there, but as soon as we concretize something, we lose this joie de vivre that's always here, this great joy. It's always here.
I want you to come back in my meditative fights and get loose.
What?
I want you to come back in my meditative fights and you better get well.
Okay, I will. I will. Yeah. All right. So you said you had two questions.
Well, the other question was about this thing in the first paragraph. It says that mountains exist before the eon of emptiness.
Okay, let me go to that phrase. Let me find that phrase here. These mountains and waters of the present are expressions of the ancient Buddhas. All phenomena realize completeness. Because they exist before the eon of emptiness, they are living in the present.
Yeah, what does that mean, exist before the eon?
Well, in lots of Eastern philosophy, emptiness comes first, and we all come out of emptiness, and in the empty eon, that was the first eon. We all emerge from formlessness. Formlessness precedes form, and actually the Taoists talk about it that way too, but Dogen says that's you're misconstruing it. That the thing that emptiness comes first is just some ideal you have in your head. That the very moving of everything has always been happening, and that's emptiness because it's form, because it's life coming from a rock, or life coming from a mountain, life coming from a practice partner you didn't ask for. So before we divide the world up into what was then and what is now, we can experience this right now, in the present. How's that?
The way it seems to me is that maybe he's saying that we don't want to hang on to the idea of emptiness too, or something. Maybe that this is...
Yeah, we think we want to return to emptiness in our zazen. Oh, I want to return to emptiness. Tim's always talking about emptiness. But there's nothing to return to. The Tim is empty who wants to return to emptiness. The wanting is empty. The emptiness is empty. So it's all form. It's all life. It's all joie de vivre. To use, I don't know any French. Eric, I know joie de vivre in French, and I know je ne parle pas français. And when I say that to my grandkids who are French, they say, Grandpa, that's not right. I can't even say I can't speak French without them going, Grandpa, be quiet. Don't say anything more. Anyway.
Nagarjuna says, those who hold on to emptiness as a view are incorrigible.
Could you say that a little louder?
Nagarjuna says that those who hold on to emptiness as a view are incorrigible.
That's right. Those who hold on to emptiness are incorrigible, says Nagarjuna. I'm letting those folks know. Yes, that's right. Anything else? Yeah.
Yeah,
Charlie.
Speaking of getting old, I saw my uncle again over the weekend, and he's getting to the point where he'll say, well, why am I still here? And it's hard to tell him he's not getting old. He's 102, so. but he's still sharp as a tack, and hates to see a lead because he loves visiting and loves history. And then the social worker comes in, and asking these questions. You know, of course he's depressed. Well, another thing is his wife is many years younger than him, and she just died over the weekend.
Oh.
Going downhill for 3 years, and she, so it was not expected, but still, well, what's the deal? You're 102 years old.
Yeah.
You just died.
Yeah.
What do you really got to?
Yeah.
And he's gone downhill considerably over the last 6 months, 3 years.
Well, sometimes we'll just be going downhill. Sometimes we'll be going uphill, and sometimes we'll be. And there is more going down at this space of life. But, you know, we could just slide down on our butts. like I try to slide down these stairs from the third floor on my butt.